Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Tamaz, I'm the chair of the RSA, and I'm absolutely delighted to welcome you to this evening's event. Tonight is a celebration of the very positive impact that design of design and the influential practitioners who are leaders in the design field. Design is very important to the RSA, and it's actually at the core of our charitable objects. And the past year has marked another important milestone for our work in this space. So, for example, we strengthened our collaborations in design and our relationships with partners in change, including with Innovate UK, who supported two design and lab projects for us. We've had a lot of high-profile success in the media, for example, with Series 2 of BBC Radio 4's The Fix, which was a programme devised and presented by the RSA and uses service design tools to address complex societal problems. We also worked with the British Council on a programme of design masterclasses, which were delivered by three royal designers for industry, Charlie Patton, Morag Myerskoff, and Andrew Grant, as part of the 2018 Saudi Design Week Festival. And of course, tonight, this very evening, we inaugurate three new Royal Designers for Industry and three new honorary Royal Designers for Industry. The RSA introduced the title RDI as long ago as 1936. That was when the design profession was, of course, in its infancy. And it was established to promote the important contribution of design in manufacturing and in industry, and to honour exceptional practitioners of all design disciplines. And now today, the RDI is the highest accolade for designers in the UK and is awarded to those who have sustained design excellence, work of aesthetic value, and of significant benefit to society overall. In recent years, the RDI nominations have been actually more explicit about the designer's outstanding contribution to society. And this criterion, this RDI criterion, is at the core of our best designers. And the RSA and everybody here is absolutely committed to celebrating that in the very broadest sense, alongside the RSA's long-standing support for design excellence. So in addition to celebrating the RDIs tonight, we're also celebrating the next generation of designers who are committed to using their skills to tackle societal challenges. And we've invited some of last year's RSA Student Design Award winners to join us for this evening's celebrations. So we're now in the 95th year of the RSA Student Design Awards. It's a global curriculum and a competition for university students and for recent graduates. So we work closely here with our cross-sector partners. These include NHS England, Twitter, Philips, Network Rail, and others. And we create a set of design briefs each year that challenge emerging change makers to address the big issues of our time through their design thinking. And so that might be, how do we design ways to transform emergency healthcare? How do we address the loneliness crisis? How do we break down societal barriers faced by people with hidden disabilities? These are just a few of the challenges that were posed by the 10 design briefs in this year's competition. And I'm very delighted to say that four of the recent winners who started out their careers in this way are here with us tonight. And it's my pleasure now to share their winning work with you all. So, first of all, Shipriya and Andrea Boccia from the Domus Academy in Italy won the award for the brief Fair Finance for All, which asks students to design a way for people who are financially excluded to be better served by financial services. And their project, which was the Well Income Service, is a service that offers refugees in Europe digital financial education and support and adapts to their changing needs over time. And the judges here were extremely impressed by that what they found to be an in-depth and a holistic solution, sensitively addressing the key challenges around trust through the ambassador model. Shri Priya has traveled from France, I'm delighted to say, to be here with us tonight. And she also shares her experiences of participating in the competition in a new film on our website. So the next one is Tim Chapman. He won the brief Eat, Share, Live, which asked students to design an inclusive, multi-generational kitchen space or a component that works for people of diverse ages and needs. And this is for Pan Pickle, which is an adhesive, heat-reactive silicon guard for electric and induction hobs to boost the confidence of visually impaired users and those with poor mobility. The jury commended Tim's, and I'm going to quote here, elegantly simple, accessible and cost-effective solution which responds to a massive need, and that it's solving one of the most dangerous problems that there exists in the kitchen. The judges were and jury were impressed by his market research, by his commercial acumen, and by his level of professionalism. And Tim is now further developing Pan Pickle and hopes to bring it to the market very soon. So the next is Gabby De Rosa, who won the brief Wearing Intelligence 2.0, which asks students to develop a design solution that utilizes advanced textiles, in other words, fabric that's been enhanced by new technologies, to improve well-being. And this was an award for the Interweave Living Fabric, an advanced textile interlaced with plants, which creates a connection that enriches and expresses our relationship with nature. The judges were absolutely blown away by Gabby's charismatic, challenging, and bold approach to dealing with biodiversity and our potential to change our behavior. Her work, they thought, was beautifully presented, and the panel were inspired by her creative bandwidth and commercial rigor in bringing together nature, science, fashion, design, and making. So Gabby was awarded a paid placement at the innovation consultancy Kinnear Dufort, and since finishing that, she's actually joined the RSA design team, so she's clearly got terrific judgment, and we are delighted to be working with her. The final winner, who's here tonight, won our special Moving Pictures animation brief, which is a collaboration with the RSA's public events team. And the brief asked students to create an animation to accompany an audio excerpt from our events program to clarify, to energize, and to illuminate the content. So Guillaume and Cameron won this brief for their animation Unclear Waters to accompany an excerpt titled Post-Truth, which is taken from an RSA talk by Matthew Dancona. This was Guillaume Boujassi's and Cameron Gleave's first animation project, and Guillaume himself is here with us tonight, I'm delighted to say. The team cleverly used water as a metaphor for information, and the panel commended their very powerful and cohesive use of water analogies, as well as fluid transitions, timeless style, and a politically neutral approach. So, I'd now like to ask all of the RSA Student Design Awards winners to be upstanding, and then could everybody else joining me in a very RSA loud round of applause. Where are you? Good, that was a good round of applause. There'll be opportunities for more. Sorry, moved on too quickly. Here comes an animation.
Facts aren't enough. Post-truth will not tumble under the bombardment of more and more and more data. We now have a duty as supporters of liberal democracy to communicate facts in a way that recognises emotional as well as rational imperatives. And that this is a very, very difficult task. Politicians, for example, really do need to align factual claims with emotional significance. You know, obviously, they shouldn't sacrifice veracity to theatricality. That would be a disaster. But politicians of the future need to recognise the adulthood of the voters and not infantilise them with a kind of machine gun spray of data. It's very, very important that you come out and you stretch out a hand to the person making the objection, but in taking the hand, you speak to them as if they were grown-ups and not just saying, don't worry your pretty little head about it. There is a debasement of political discourse, which I think is really alarming.
Can't disagree with that. Very good. So all the talented young designers who just stood up will be downstairs with their winning projects in the Benjamin Franklin room after the event tonight. So I'd encourage everybody to go and have a word with them and understand about their work and what they have as aspirations for the future and what they gained from working on these projects. So before we turn our attention now to the RDI presentations, I'd just like to thank the Royal Designers for their ongoing commitment to the RSA. As judges and advocates of the Pupil Design Awards and Student Design Awards, you are an inspiration to the next generation of designers for social change. Many of you have also given your time to share your design knowledge and the inspiring stories that you've brought with the pupils and teachers in the RSA family of academies. So, Mary Restio, RDI, ran a textile and dyeing workshop with A-level art students from Whitley Academy in Coventry. Pupils spent the day absorbed in colour and weaving and considering careers in the creative industries. Helen Story, RDI, and her colleague Caroline Coates, they supported the Mental Pictures Project, which invited pupils from five of the RSA schools to design a school-wide creative campaign addressing mental health and well-being issue of their choosing. And Morag herself, who's just been a judge of a pupil's social action projects at today's RSA Academy's takeover day, was also central to the Mental Pictures Project. Maybe she'll say a word about that later. And opened the eyes of the pupils to the use of bold colour and to the joy to be found in the everyday world. So a huge thank you to all of those folks. Thank you very much indeed. Following the RDA presentations tonight, which we'll complete in a minute, we're going to be hearing from Morag, who's brought a banner and lots of stories, and she will give this year's RDI address. But for now, what I'd like to do is hand over to the Master of the Royal Designers and Deputy Chair of ARUP, Tristram Crafray. And Tristram is going to invite the new members of the faculty to receive their diplomas. Tristram.
So thank you, Tim, and good evening, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. I'm delighted that the Royal Designers are engaged with the RSA, helping with the Student Design Awards and improving design education through the RSA Academies. I think you can also see some RDI handiwork downstairs in the brilliant recreation of the Rothwell Coffee House, which if you haven't been there yet, I encourage you to go and visit. I think it's a fantastic installation. That is the coffee house itself, as well as the RDI artifacts. So as creativity in general and design in particular become increasingly important through the rest of the 21st century, we welcome the development of a greater and closer relationship between the faculty of RDIs and the RSA. It now gives me, of course, great pleasure to welcome the new Royal Designers for 2018. As already mentioned by Tim, we have three Royal Designers for Industry and three honorees. The difference is Royal Designers for Industry are British citizens, and the honorary Royal Designers are those who are not British citizens. So I will start with Marion Duchars. Marion Duchars is a Scottish-born, internationally acclaimed, award-winning illustrator with a very personal approach. Marion first studied illustration and printmaking at the Duncan of Jordanston College of Art, and then illustration at the Royal College of Art here in London, graduating in 1989 with a distinction. Following her graduation, Marion, along with fellow RCA students, formed a multidisciplinary studio in North London, where I believe she continues to work today. Marion's innate skill in visualising words, together with her much-admired hand lettering with either pen or brush, gives her work such a poetic quality. Marion's distinctive and often copied hand lettering has been featured on the cover of Esquire, in The Guardian, in Jamie Oliver's cookbooks, and on Royal Mail stamps. Her reputation has been built on her strengths, not only as designer and illustrator, but also as an author, with her Bob the Artist series winning numerous awards, both in the UK and worldwide. Her Let's Make Some Great Art books inspire children to discover the transformative powers of art in a fun and engaging way, and have been translated into 22 languages, selling over 250,000 copies. Whilst digital technology might offer more expedient ways of communicating ideas, Marion's head, heart, and hand approach provides a wonderful counterpoint. Her impact on the creative scene continues with the recent publication of Colour for Penguin Books. Marion's impact on society can be measured not only by the sale of her books, but by the popularity of her much-appreciated workshops for children. Marion believes passionately that participation in the subject of art should be encouraged at all levels. Her international reputation is reflected in numerous awards, including an Art Directors Club New York Gold and Silver, 3 much-coveted D&AD Yellow Pencils, a Tokyo Art Directors Club Award, as well as the 2010 V&A Illustration Award. Marion was also one of 6 designers selected by the British Council to represent the UK at the 2012 Helsinki World Design Capital Celebrations. So, Marion, please join us on the stage to receive your award. We are... We are delighted that you're about to add Royal Designer for Industry to all your other prestigious awards and offer you a heartfelt welcome to the faculty. Welcome. The next recipient of an RDI award is Ez Devlin. Widely regarded as one of the world's most talented set designers, Ez has consistently produced work of outstanding quality and impact that has challenged standard ideas about stagecraft and its role in and for society. After graduating from Bristol University with a BA in English, Ez took a Fine Art Foundation course at Central St Martins in 1995 before completing the Motley Theatre Design course that allowed her to combine her love of words, music and making things. Ez's early works were in small experimental theatres in London, including The Bush and The Gate. Her canvas has expanded over the past 2 decades through the National Theatre, Sadler's Wells, Royal Opera House and La Scala. And then it was a phone call, I believe, from Kanye West in 2005 that started a new chapter, with Ez moving into the world of huge stadium tours, collaborating with artists including Kanye, U2, Beyoncé and Adele, and venues such as the O2 Arena, Wembley Stadium and the Olympic Stadiums of both London and Rio. The impact of Ez Devlin's work is manifold, yet her influence on public culture and perception has been particularly significant. For the closing ceremony of London 2012 Olympics, Ez transformed the whole stadium into a massive abstract Union Jack. The ceremony, entitled A Symphony of British Music, was a celebration both of the achievements of the Olympic Games athletes and the significance of Britain's contribution to the international art and music scene over the last half century. An expression of the unique national cohesion generated by the Olympics, the work articulated the energy, diversity, anarchy, and multiplicity of contemporary British culture, something that without Ez's vision simply would not have been possible. Her work is profoundly innovative and utilises techniques which are also at the very front of technology. Her work on the V&A singing tree in Christmas 2017 combined contemporary algorithmic analysis, new forms of music making, and recent developments in projection mapping to generate an interactive installation. The tree took the form of a cloud of floating words contributed by visitors to the V&A Museum. Using thousands of these words, as well as sound algorithms trained on 25 million words of 19th century poetry, The tree emitted audio-visual carols in the form of an interactive cumulative choir of human and synthesized voices, thus marrying the traditional community carol singing with state-of-the-art machine learning. More recently, Ez has been selected with Patrick Bellew RDI to create the UK's pavilion at the next World Expo in Dubai in 2020. The commission follows in the footsteps of UK's previous pavilions, with Royal designers Thomas Heatherwick and Brian Eno contributing in 2010 and 2017, respectively. Other notable solo installation works by Ez include Room 2022 in Miami, 2017, Mirror Maze in Peckham, London in 2016, Playbox at the Belgian Stadstriennale in 2016, and Poem Portraits at the Serpentine Gallery in 2017. And this year, of course, she added a fifth poetry-spouting lion in Trafalgar Square as a striking element of London's design festival. Her distinctive practice straddles the fields of art, opera, dance, theatre, fashion, and music, and has helped engender innovative forms of kinetic sculpture and space. Yet she is also a critical designer. A continual interrogation of her own practice distinguishes Ez from her contemporaries and means that each and every of her designs is unexpected yet appropriate, complex yet accessible, pragmatic yet sublime. Along the way, Ez has been awarded dozens of accolades, including 3 Olivier Awards, Evening Standard Critics Circle and Wall Street Journal Innovation Award 2016, and she is an honorary fellow of UAL London and was awarded an OBE in 2015. So, Ez, please step forward. As your skills and experience will be exceptionally valuable to both the RSA and the faculty, and we welcome you warmly as a Royal Designer. Next and last of our RDIs this evening is Ben Terrett. In 1997, Ben Terrett was awarded the RSA Student Design Award for his interactive graphics project. His early career developed at various small agencies, immersing himself in digital design. And in 2001, he set up the Design Conspiracy to concentrate on the possibilities of digital work. Ben later joined the agency Whedon & Kennedy as creative director for the Observer Guardian account, working on graphics, digital commercials, and advertising campaigns, for which he won the 2010 Campaign Press Ad of the Year Award. As a creative entrepreneur, Ben co-formed Newspaper Club, creating online software to allow users to design and print their own 12-page tabloid newspapers. It was an immediate success, winning the graphics category of the 2010 Design Museum's Designs of the Year. In 2011, Ben joined the Cabinet Office to advise on the government digital service. He progressed to become the design director of GDS, heading up the team delivering gov.uk, which reduced 2,000 chaotic, uncoordinated government department websites into one clear, simple piece of brilliant service design. Transforming gov.uk with its ease of usability and language has increased the entire UK population's speed of access to information. Over 98% of driving tests are now booked online, 85% of self-assessment tax filing is done online, and 12 million people have registered to vote online. These are notable achievements, and they've come about through hard work, collaboration, and clear creative direction by Ben and his multidisciplinary team to implement innovative digital capabilities. In the first 3 years, gov.uk saved £3.6 billion and substantially improved the services for millions of people. In 2015, Ben joined the Co-op as Group Design Director to recreate the brand for a digital era and demonstrate a different way of doing business for an increasingly connected community. Ben's work for the Co-op improved business, customer, and staff communications. Ben is a governor of the University of the Arts London, a member of the HS2 Design Panel, and an advisor to the London Design Festival. He lectures globally on how design is changing the world and how the internet is changing design. Ben and his team have won various industry awards over the years, including the Beazley Design Museum's Design of the Year and a DNAD black pencil for their work on gov.uk. In 2017, Ben was inducted into the Design Week Hall of Fame. Ben, please step forward. So, Ben, it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the Faculty of Royal Designers, where I think your deep understanding of digital communication will be particularly useful. Now we move on to the honorary RDIs, those who are not British citizens. The first of which may surprise you, Ferran Adria. Ferran is one of the world's most influential gastronomic designers, revered by most of his customers and by many well-respected and acclaimed chefs as one of, if not the, greatest living chef. Adria's journey began aged 18 when he took a job washing dishes in a hotel restaurant in order to finance a trip to Ibiza. In 1982, he joined the Navy to fulfill his compulsory military service and eventually became chef to an admiral. At the end of his service, he accepted a one-month internship at El Bulli, a respected French restaurant on the Costa Brava. In early 1984, he was hired as a line cook, and 3 years later, Adria had become the restaurant's sole chef de cuisine. During the mid-80s, El Bulli's menu featured a combination of traditional French recipes and nouvelle cuisine, but Adria sought to explore other culinary avenues. Gradually, he began to experiment with new techniques for preparing and presenting food, and became a protagonist of technique concept cuisine, in which he subjected potential ingredients to rigorous experimentation and scientific analysis as a means of creating novel dishes that produce gloriously unexpected sensations. By the late 1990s, El Bulli had attracted copious praise within the culinary world, and Adria earned a top rating of 3 stars from the vaunted Guide Michelin. Adria's innovations became widely imitated under the rubric Molecular Gastronomy. In 2002, the British magazine Restaurant named El Bulli the best eatery in the world, a distinction it also held from 2006 to 2009 inclusively. El Bulli became a pilgrimage site for gourmands worldwide. In 2007, in recognition of the artistic dimension of his work, the Cassel Documenta, considered to be one of the most influential events in the world of contemporary art, invited Adria as an artist and chef, causing enormous consternation and controversy in the art world at the time. Though this publicity created enormous demand, his cuisine was so ambitious and exacting that he could only serve a limited number of diners per year, and El Bulli consistently operated at a loss. He refused to increase prices, even when 2 million diners were fighting for only 8,000 available meals per season. Adria compensated by selling books and other self-branded merchandise, but in 2011 he closed El Bulli and transformed it into a non-profit foundation for culinary research. Adria is, if you like, the Le Corbusier of chefs, a visionary, brilliant, radical, and innovative designer. Like many of the world's greatest designers, his work is a bridge between awe-inspiring original art and breakthrough design. Also a brilliant engineer and a poet whose medium happens to be gastronomy. Unfortunately, Ferran is unable to join us this evening, but has instead sent us this message by video.
Hola, ¿qué tal? Antes que nada, disculparme por no estar con vosotros. Ya que, sin duda alguna, es uno de los reconocimientos que más importantes de mi carrera y la verdad es que me ha hecho mucha ilusión. ¿Por qué? Desde hace años estoy aprendiendo con personas relacionadas con el mundo del diseño y del arte. Sin duda alguna, el Bulli y Ferradia no sería lo que es sin esta relación holística donde hemos aprendido mucho. Además, hemos trabajado conjuntamente. Aquí, todo esto que veis aquí, es todos los resultados innovadores que hemos hecho alrededor del diseño del Bulli. Esto es un ejemplo. Seguramente si veis Chef Table o programas de televisión, veréis que se utilizan muchas pinzas como esta. Y esto es un trabajo conjunto entre el diseño y la cocina. En el año 2000 nos emocionamos y vimos la diferencia entre comer con palillos japoneses o asiáticos y un cuchillo y un tenedor occidental. Podríamos decir que nosotros somos unos bárbaros y ellos tienen mucha sensibilidad. ¿Qué sucedía? Que si ponía palillos asiáticos, dirían que hacía cocina asiática. Entonces, con Lucky Huber, diseñador, diríamos esto. Cambiemos una actividad de una herramienta para darla a otra. Sin vosotros, fuera sido imposible. Entonces, muchas, muchas gracias y espero ir a Londres y vernos pronto. Ya digo que es un reconocimiento que tendré en el corazón. Muchas gracias.
Would Fernando Gutierrez, RDI, please join us to collect the honorary RDI award on behalf of Fernando. The second honorary RDI is to Shigeru Ban. Shigeru Ban is an architect who designs beautiful buildings using unusual natural materials, and his work often also has a strong humanitarian purpose. Ban was born in Tokyo, Japan, and he studied at the Tokyo University of the Arts and then at the Southern California Institute of Architecture. Later, he transferred to Cooper Union School of Architecture, graduating in 1984. In 1985, Ban started his own practice in Tokyo. Between 1985 and 86, as the curator of the Axis Gallery in Tokyo, he organized and designed the installations of an Emilio Ambaz exhibition, Alva Aalto exhibition, and a Judith Turner exhibition. While developing the paper tube structures that he implemented for the first time at the Aalto exhibition, Ban designed his PC Pile House, House of Double Roof, Furniture House, Curtain Wall House, 2-5 House, Wallless House, and Naked House, as a series of case studies into alternative strategies for house building. Most of which, by the way, are based on the idea of using either his paper tubes or furniture items or others as the very structure of the house itself. When Ban discovered that the 2 million refugees from the 1994 Rwandan Civil War were forced to live in terrible conditions, he proposed paper tube shelters to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and they hired him as a consultant. After the Great Hanshin, or Kobe, earthquake in 1995, he built the paper log house for the former Vietnamese refugees who were not able to live in the temporary houses provided by the Japanese government. He also built the Takatori Paper Church with student volunteers, and this was the trigger to establish the Voluntary Architects Network NGO and to continue his disaster relief activities. Ban has designed a broad range of projects that reconcile technical inventiveness, aesthetic sensibility, and social commitment. Empathetic design is at the forefront of all of Ban's work. Believing that architecture should be used to help those in need, Ban's disaster relief work has created enormous social change. The 2013 Cardboard Cathedral was in response to the Christchurch earthquake of 2011, and this elegant temporary cathedral gave back Christchurch's symbol of the city, re-establishing a place of hope within the wreckage. The 2008 Hualin Temporary Elementary School in China enabled children to get back to school within 40 days after the Sichuan earthquake. It is important for Ban to learn about how local people construct in order to transfer his knowledge. The ongoing 2018 paper tube housing in Kenya uses previous knowledge about local construction methods and cultural skills such as weaving. No specialized skills are needed to create an understandable and easy assembly of Ban's devising. He demonstrates his considered design approach to uniting people, systems, and solutions. BAND's work has created enormous impact, spanning from disaster relief through commercial and residential to key international cultural buildings. His 2017 Mount Fuji World Heritage Centre celebrates a landmark of both cultural and symbolic value. After recently being made a UNESCO site, the building provides a space for visitors to understand and observe the importance of the mountain. BAND's 2010 work on the Centre Pompidou Metz Art Centre, dedicated to modern and contemporary art, was developed in collaboration with the greater community. BAND has been committed to design education throughout his career. He's a professor in 8 different universities, including Harvard, and consequently made an honorary fellow and doctor at a number of institutions, including the Cooper Union in New York. The Voluntary Architects Foundation has enabled and encouraged positive social change through architecture. BAND has won numerous awards. In 2014, he was the 37th recipient of the Pritzker Architecture Prize. The jury cited his innovative use of material and his dedication to humanitarian efforts around the world, calling him a committed teacher who is not only a role model for younger generation, but also an inspiration. Always innovative, Shigeru BAND's work is ultimately about responsive, economical, and sustainable architecture to create beautiful buildings and help those in need. Again, unfortunately, Shigeru is unable to join us tonight and sends his apologies, but Charlie Payton, RDI, will collect his honorary award on his behalf. Our last honorary RDI goes to Glenn Murcutt, another architect and arguably Australia's most famous architect. He's influenced generations of architects and paved the way to sustainable design. Murcutt epitomises the most significant change in architectural design of the last half century. His work defines the principle of sustainability long before that word became recognised. The Aboriginal-inspired phrase he uses about his own work is that it touches the earth lightly. He combines innovative contemporary design with a pragmatic economy of means, reduction of energy consumption, and a focus on recyclability. Murcutt occupies a unique position on the architectural stage. One recent biographer described him as the spiritual guardian of Australian architecture, but his inspiration through practice and teaching is truly global. Murcutt is a master craftsman, a pragmatist who understands the integrity of the material he enjoys working with, and who has consistently developed an innovative approach to architecture and design over half a century of practice. His buildings often sit gently suspended above the ground, beautifully detailed caskets for living that always respond to their specific context and climate. His work embraces such issues as the fragility of a continent, cultural identity, drought, suburban sprawl, climate change, and the wanton squandering of resources to prop up lifestyles fueled by oil and excessive consumption. His eloquent hand drawings capture the essence of an interrogatory design process, thought translated into timeless reality. It required a pioneering spirit like Glenn Murcutt to demonstrate, by creating beautiful and functional naturally ventilated buildings, that air conditioning was not actually needed in the Australian climate, and that such bioclimatic design could dramatically reduce energy consumption. It was a radical approach in the 70s to suggest that careful solar shading, natural ventilation, and rainwater collection could all play their part in creating a very different relationship between the built and natural environments. Murcutt has been refining his approach for 50 years and continues to surprise us with extraordinary design solutions. Murcutt has a significant global reputation. He conducts summer schools that he set up 15 years ago, which are renowned throughout the world. Despite being a sole practitioner, he has won virtually every major architectural award in the world. He has 2 AIA gold medals, one from the American Institute and one from the Australian one. He also is a Pritzker Prize winner and has been awarded the Alva Aalto Medal. But in an age of the Starkitect, Murcutt and his work offer a model of dignity and consistency. For Merkert, every project is a research exercise. His most recent work is a complete redefinition of the idea of a mosque built in the suburbs of Melbourne. Instead of a complete enclosure, the fourth wall of the prayer hall is open to the courtyard. And once inside, a dramatic series of roof lights gives the interior space a transcendent quality. This reinvention of the mosque is just the latest example of continuous and constant innovation that has characterised Merkert's work for the last half century. And having spent 20 years living in Australia, I can personally attest to his brilliance, and he is a worthy recipient of an honorary RDI, but unfortunately also unable to join us tonight. So Peter Clegg, RDI, if you'd like to come and collect Glenn's award on his behalf. I have now lost the last bit of my notes, but never mind. I think, having welcomed all the new honorary designers for this year, I have another announcements to make before we move over to tonight's speaker, Murad Myerscough. So one is to announce that Mark Major has accepted and agreed, luckily for me, to be the next master of the RDIs, and he takes his post a year from today, and will continue to work with us on the committee as the master-elect for the next year. So, Mark, thank you very much, and congratulations. Unfortunately, though, this wonderful introduction of Mark comes with the departure of the wonderful Betty Jackson. For 4 years now, Betty has been master-elect, master, and immediate past master, and has done it with absolute charm and grace, and navigated, and her diplomacy, I think, through those 4 years, have been absolutely stellar, and we will miss you sorely, Betty. So thank you very much for your contribution. And then my last duty is to introduce our tonight's speaker, the main course of the event, Murad Myerscough.
Good evening, everybody. I've had actually a really amazing afternoon judging the Academy projects, and the young people were phenomenally good on stage, and I learnt quite a lot from them. But I think they'd be better than me. So anyway, we're going to start. So this is my mantra: make happy those who are near and those who are far will come. And it's what I sort of try to aim at most of the time. I'm London-born, London-bred. I come from Holloway in North London, and until I die and then I'm dead. My mum used to always say, I'm never going to move from London. I'm just stuck here. So this is my family. This is my great-grandfather, who was originally in the workhouse in Farringdon and escaped to the circus. And he was in the circus. And this is my great-grandmother. She was German, and she joined the circus. This is the circus in Paris. It ended up being a permanent circus. She joined the circus with no skill. So They decided that this would be her skill. So she was a high diver. And I didn't really realise this until I saw this film, The Caravan, what a high diver was. For some reason, I thought it was a trapeze or something. But they jump into this small bowl of water at the bottom. And she did that probably every day. So I thought I was brave coming up here, but I think that's probably braver than me. And I could be here all night, don't worry, I'm not going to be. My great-great-grandmother got her son back. She was still living in London, and she got her son back, who was the circus, who was a clown, to London. And my family have lived in the same house in Holloway for over 120 years. And all the family came over. So my French grandmother came over, and her father was a salon painter in Paris. And this is how we really fitted in Holloway. And it was sort of quite an interesting upbringing. And my father was a classical musician, and his brother also was a violinist. He won the Festival of Britain for violin, and that's my dad when he did his Wigmore Hall. So, and I think it's why I've always loved condensed fonts as well. So we lived in these two houses in the middle of this working class area in Holloway that has always been a migratory area as well. But it was quite special. And when I went to... So I'd come home and it was music and making. This is my Scottish mother and this is me in the middle. And she was a textile artist. She was here last year, but sadly she's not with us anymore. And this is me. So I didn't really like playing... I didn't really like my dad practicing, and I can't play an instrument and I can't speak French either. So... But I did like making, and it was so amazing being this household of making. But when I went to school, it was very different. So I always wanted to speak Cockney, and my dad would always tell me off when I came home. So it was living in these two different worlds, really, and I never really felt like I fitted in around me. So we used to have, we were given this spaceship when we were for our living room. My mum didn't give us Wendy houses, no, we had a spaceship. And we used to escape into the, you know, to go to different countries, to different planets, me and my sister. But my grandmother, interesting, my French grandmother, going back to that image, that is the house in Holloway. She totally transformed her house in Holloway to be like a French salon. So it was how she believed, how she made her own sense of belonging in an environment that was completely alien to her outside. But when she got inside the house, that was her space. So fast forward, when I was Myra Hindley, sorry, I shouldn't joke about that, but that's me. I went to St. Martin's and the Royal College, and then I went to the Royal College, and I think maybe the subject wasn't totally right for me, but I didn't quite fit in. I was meant to be doing posters probably, and I was doing opera sets, but I think we got on, everything went on okay, but I think maybe for a while I didn't really pursue exactly where my heart was. And for a long time I wanted to find where I belonged and where I fitted in things. And so actually, weirdly for me, because I was a middle child and I never had any space, I was the youngest for a little while and then I became the middle one, I had this desire for space, and I found this building in 2005, and suddenly I walked in there and I thought that was it for me. It was about space, about where I could do whatever I wanted, and that was what belonging meant to me. And what I've been trying to work out is what belonging means. To belong means lots of things to different people, and I've been trying to discover what that might be. And so in my studio, my house, it's so brilliant. I can just get up in the morning and I can paint. And then this is my old dog, actually, but I have a new one, Elvis. And then sometimes I work on my own, and sometimes I work with Luke, who's in the audience. And then sometimes I get loads and loads of people, and the studio gets really active, and we all paint together, and it's really collective. It's fantastic. So when I discovered my sense of belonging, I wanted to see, can I make work where people feel like it belongs to them, they're part of it, and then they will have it afterwards and do what they want with it. So this was a project actually I did with Luke in Graz in Austria, where it was a festival. And what they wanted to address was the problem with migration, or the lack of integration in Graz. It's a real divide, and they really wanted this arts festival, even though it was a temporary, just to get the dialogue moving and make a change. So this is a socialist workers' building on the edge of the People's Park. It was not really the People's Park. It was really a sad park, and we wanted to activate this. And so the idea was it was all open doors to make a structure that anybody could enter at any space. And so I really, really think it's important to work with the community to get people involved. So I worked with 10 or 11 groups of different social groups, and even with older people, not just little ones. But these guys were brilliant because there was loads of testosterone. They were so funny because they were all like these teenagers, and they're in this youth club, and it was all graffiti. And then this woman comes along with these patterns, and we paid them €5 to do it. But actually, they really, really loved doing it. And the leader of the gang just spent ages doing this really, really beautiful piece of work. And then I translated it. So this was his one with all the hearts on it. And because he did it, all the others joined in, and they just all wanted to be part of it. And it was such an amazing experience. So these were made of big banners along the streets in Graz. And then this was the actual piece. So I also worked with an art gallery, Rotor, and they were working with all the communities. And every few days, they would make different meals inside the space. So this is the space. And everybody shared all their knowledge, all their different recipes, and then they made a recipe book. And it was there for like 4 or 5 weeks, and it just really, really made an impact to the community. And it was very relaxed, making things together. So this is an area, I've worked quite a lot of projects in hospitals, and I really, really admire the people who commission artists for hospitals and their vision of who they want to do things, and particularly at Vital Arts. They're amazing over at Whitechapel Royal London Hospital. So this is a few years ago now, and I've worked with the poet Lem Cisse. And when you work with patients in hospital, it's very different to schools. The children maybe have lots of drugs or medication, and they're obviously not very well. Their families are there, and you have to be very, very sensitive when you work with them. So Lem Cisse, he did some workshops, word workshops with the young patients. And then I took their, and then I did some visual workshops, and I found which words they liked. And then I made this alphabet and used their words on the wall and made these five dining rooms for them. And it doesn't cost a lot of money. You know, these, I think there was £5,000 for the whole project, but we made it happen, and we did all these dining rooms, and I chose all the furniture as well. And this was lovely. This was by a 7-year-old who was half in Urdu and half in English, and it was sweet. And they loved, this was for 2-year-olds, the nurses were a bit worried. They loved the word dazzle, but it's still there. So you know, I think that proves that it must be all right. But so I've been allowed into the public spaces in hospitals, but I have not been allowed in the bedrooms because that's a very sensitive space. But there was an amazing Kat Powell, who runs Artfelt Trust, which is the trust in Sheffield Children's Hospital, had seen me speak somewhere, and this commission came up, and she said, she rang me up and she said, "Will you do some bedrooms?" And I was like, "Oh, I'd love to get my hands on the bedrooms." So Avanti Architects had designed these spaces, which are really nice, and they put everything neatly away. But they weren't, these were for children who were going to maybe stay there for months on end with their mums and dads. And, you know, you wanted to make them feel better. So I wanted to introduce wood and various things. So I went up to a big group of clinical staff, nurses, everything, and I went up and I showed them all these designs, and they're really nice to me. And I thought, well, that went quite well. You know, maybe just work out what ones they might like. And then the next day, the Kat Powell rang me. She said, "Maureen, they thought you were really nice, but they don't want you to touch those bedrooms because you're going to kill those children." And I was like, no, it's okay. Let's not overreact to the situation. You're looking at something on screen. Let's work out how we can work this out. So what I decided to do is make these little models. I was experimenting to see how far I could go. So I chose the ones that were a little gentler. And I made all these little models. I sent them up in a box to Kat. I didn't want to be there because I didn't want to influence anything. And they showed them all to the patients and some of the clinical staff. And you can see that 92% said yes. They were so happy. So we represented to the clinical staff, and all they said to me is, can you give me, out of 48 bedrooms, can you give me 6 bedrooms of blue? Because blue and green is calm. And so, and I said, yes, that's brilliant. And they had worked with me on changing the way they were going to do things, and then they said, that's okay, we can make, you can make all the rest happen. So these are the actual bedrooms. I didn't put the teddy bears on the beds for the photographs. I think they're cute, but I didn't put them on. So these are the bedrooms. And it's wood laminate, everything's laminate, but it was about giving warmth and joy and simple, and also not just to be for one age group, for many age groups. So am I doing okay for time? I don't know. I'm not watching my time. Have I got 4 minutes or something? So finding magic. Now, I don't know whether you know South London Gallery, but they are absolutely phenomenal. And this is Sue Garden Estate. And this was before Grenfell. And this was when everybody was meant to have learnt the lessons that people, you know, had died by staying in their flats. And Sue, and South London Gallery have been working tirelessly with the people, the families and everything in Sue Garden Estate, and they set up this little gallery. And I just want to, I might not play the whole of it, but I just want to play a little bit of this film. So I was commissioned, they refurbished that building that I showed you, and in the bottom of it they put this gallery, and South London Gallery now get an artist or designer each year to work with the kids to make their space their own. And this was my one last year. So this is a really exciting day. As you can hear, there's lots of people doing art. I'm Morag Myerskov, I'm a designer and artist. And at the moment, I'm at the opening of the art block.
I'm very pleased to welcome you to this celebration of the opening of art block. Art Block is part of Open Plan, which is a bigger programme played out across 3 estates local to South London Gallery, with the aim of bringing artists into the everyday life of residents, but also with the aim of involving residents more in the life of the South London Gallery.
It's a new art block where the kids can come and just do art, make things and just enjoy themselves. They had had a space that they had made their own, and it was an amazing identity, little small space. And then they were given this wonderful new space. It was a white-walled new building that it didn't belong to them. So the whole part of my brief was to come and make a space that they belong to. So the way I approached that was to get them to make the art. So I did workshops with them, pattern workshops, word workshops and various things. And then out of it, I took their work and then I transformed it into the space that you can see now.
My name is Kudada and I'm 9 years old. At one of the workshops, I did a little bit of art and we had to design our own kind of like picture. So there was kind of shapes and we had to make our own picture out of it. The thing that I like about the new place is that the new place is big, because the old space was too small for me to dance, but now the big space is better for me to do that. And there's lots of different colours on the walls.
My project is named The Club Under My House, and we got that from one of the workshops with the young people, where we had a poet that came in and he worked with them.
What is this place?
Maybe it'll be the art club.
A club, okay. Do you want to write that down? A club under your house. I like that. If you had a club under your house, what would that club be? What would go on there? What would you like people to feel like when they see the art? Happy. Okay, I think that's really...
So, because I'm conscious of time. So the last project I'm going to speak about, which is my... this year's placard is my We Make Belonging project. I really like watching television, and I think I used to watch it a lot, when particularly old films. And this is my absolute all-time favourite Top Hat And I love the bandstand in Top Hat. So I've always wanted to make a bandstand. And it might take a while for them to dance. But anyway, it's worth watching. It's worth watching on a big screen as well. So I just really love bandstands because to me it says free entertainment. It's open, it's public, it's for everybody. And I like the structure of it and I like where you find them. So Ditchling Museum in Sussex got me to go down there and they said to me, you know, Morag, what do you really want to do? And I said, I want to make this belonging bandstand. And they said, well, interestingly, we're going to do a project with of Carita Kent. She was a sister, but she changed. She gave up in the end. So she's Carita Kent rather than Sister Carita. And Carita Kent was this amazing woman in Las Vegas. No, not in Las Vegas. Was it Las Vegas? California. Sorry, Luke. Sorry. In California, and she was friends with the Eames, and she was an educator, and she believed everybody could be designers, everybody could be artists, and that you work together, and she did this amazing work with people, and she's wrote this book about learning by heart, and it's all her thoughts about teaching and about how you should look at things and how you should see things. And even though I was introduced to her work in 2007, I never actually got into so much depth about it. And then I started reading this book and I was like going, oh my gosh, this is just so amazing. There's so many similar thought processes. So when I started thinking about my belonging bandstand, I looked at the different exercises she has in this book, and then I incorporated them into my workshops, and I worked on 9 workshops, and the whole idea of the bandstand, it was with Ditchling and it was also with the Brighton Festival, that it would tour round Brighton and Sussex for to 9 different places, and each place it stopped belonged to the people who had contributed to it. So this was a lovely lovely workshop in Ditchling where all these groups had never, ever done a workshop like this before and they just were so happy. And it was so, it just really warm, you know, it's just really incredible when you can introduce people to new things. And then New Haven have got, New Haven on here. This is a very young group of people who want to sort of get going, really get everybody to belong together. And they actually set up from these workshops their own festival, their belonging festival. And then in the workshops, we did words and everybody's idea of what belonging meant to them. And what I found out is with the older groups, with the community groups, it was about their friends. It wasn't about their family anymore. It was more about just the immediate people, how they all connected to each other. And then with the little children, obviously it's their mums and dads or their animals or their wider family. And then teenagers, it's their friends. So belonging changes throughout your life at different times, and it's who you connect with. But these were all their words, and they briefed me about how I should make their placards to go onto the bandstand. So this is all what belonging meant to each of the groups. And then I worked with Brighton University to help me paint these placards, and these are the placards. Then I painted the rest of the bandstand on my own in the studio. Dog didn't help too much, but it was good. And then this is the bandstand. So the idea is there was this crown of placards, and whenever it moved to each of the social groups, they could put their messages on the front, and then it was all together as well. And this was it in Brighton. So it was a collective piece in Brighton. But this is the one that I love the most, where behind there is a community group, and there had been a community centre, and there had been lots of arts things going on in there. But it wasn't until we put the bandstand out on the grass that all these people started gravitating towards it, and they didn't really realise that. They didn't even think about it. They just loved the bandstand, and then they wanted to keep it. But I think the idea is, actually temporary is good. Maybe that it could return to them. They don't need to keep it, but it gave them that energy that they needed at the time. So, and then it toured to 9 places, and each one had its own identity, and they programmed what went on it. So, my last message is just remember to play. So just always have fun doing your work, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.